this deal myself. If you want to hire me back, you'll hire me back. Wait a minute, the old man says. He's puffing on his pipe like crazy. We don't want that. We don't want that. I looked at David. You can't have it both ways, I told him. If you want to put obstacles in the path of this deal, you're going to scuttle a deal. I don't have any trouble if you want to get audited numbers on Kenner, which you'll have to have anyway for the insurance companies. By the way, it turned out that Haft, Stettinius, and Hollister, the finest law firm in Cincinnati, was representing the Steiners. These were solid people. Brown grumbled a bit, but he knew I was right. I was bringing in a significant piece of business, while David, by comparison, was producing very little. He okayed the deal. I made two phone calls, one to a guy I knew at Ohio National Life Insurance Company, and the other to a guy at Western and Southern Life Insurance, both Cincinnati companies. Both guys said the same thing. Why didn't they come to us in the first place? They're right here in town. I don't know why they didn't come to you, I told each of them, but they've hired us, and I think we can make a nice deal here. The guy from Western and Southern said, we want the whole deal. I said, no, I've offered it out to somebody else, too. If he wants in, let's see what we can do. Within a week, they both wanted to do the deal. Both firms took $2.5 million. Within 30 days, the deal closed, and the $100,000 commission came in. I went to the old man and said, look, Mr. Brown, I don't want to go through this every time. We all know about the Steiners. They're solid as a rock. They're highly respected by all the retailers who are their customers. They're respected by all the bankers, and they're solid citizens in Cincinnati. I said, Mr. Brown, it's hard enough to sell a deal in the first place. I'm willing to work my ass off, but I don't want to have to sell a deal, then come back and have to sell it to you guys all over again. I want you to know that if you have a question of ethics or integrity or values, or there's the slightest chances we're dealing with people we shouldn't be near, I'll be the first guy to kill the deal. He took his pipe out of his mouth and got straight to the point. What do you want? 30%, I told him. All right, fella, Mr. Brown said. The firm gets 70% and 30% goes into Unit 15. 55% of that goes to you. The rest is divvied up among your partners. My three partners, who were strictly salesmen, they wouldn't have known a deal like this if they tripped over it. Each got a nice gift of $4.5 grand. I netted $16,500, which is over twice my annual salary, and bought our first house in Manhasset on the right side of the tracks. Elaine and I and the boys moved out of that rented cottage in Brookville, and we never looked back. A couple of months later, I got a call from Warren Cavior, whom I'd met through my office mate at the Equitable, John Turner. Warren was doing PR work for a company in the garment district called Colonial Corporation of America. They made shirts and pajamas. He said, Colonial CFO is a guy by the name of Lou Epstein. You ought to meet him. I went up there and had lunch with Epstein. After we ate, he lit up a big cigar. It seemed Colonial was doing very well. They worked the way the schmata business often does. It would make a pattern, a sample, and then go out and get orders for the garment, then get the thing manufactured. They sold to Sears and all the big discount stores because they had good price points. The stores would sell the clothing under their own house brand names, and Epstein told me that Colonial needed to raise $10 million to build a new plant in Tennessee. So I went back down to Pressbridge, and I walked into David G.'s office and said, David, I've got another deal, Colonial Corporation of America. What do they do? He asked. They make pajamas, I said. That's a tough business. Yeah, it's a tough business, I said. They need a substantial sum, and we're dealing with sophisticated investors, so we're going to have to do some substantial due diligence. Colonial is going to have to give us audited statements. They're going to have to give us all kinds of documentation. We have to find out if there are any problems here before a nickel changes hands. What will you tell them about our fee? I'm going to say 2%, I said. Why don't we do the Goldman Sachs fee, David said. What's that? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, he said. 5% on the first million we raise, 4% on the second million, 3% on the third, 2% on the fourth, 1% on everything 5 million and over. David, I said, you know what I don't like about that? It's too damn complicated. I'd rather just go for 2%, I said. It's my deal. I'm going to do it the way I want to. He gave me a grudging nod. Still, David and the rest of his department couldn't stop being nervous about the Shmata business, which, after all, lives on credit. Garment companies have to borrow money every quarter to finance the next season's line. So I did a lot of checking up on Colonial Corporation, and what came back loud and clear was that Colonial was crushing everybody on price and quality and making big money. So we did the deal. Now, once I did a deal, I'd always stay in touch with the company. I'd always call the Steiners out in Cincinnati, for example, and ask how they were doing. So one day I called Lou Epstein. "Lou, how are you?" I said. He said he was doing fine. "Anything going on?" I said. "Well, nothing more than what we're doing with you right now," he said. "What do you mean, what you're doing with us right now?" "Yeah," he said. "We have this customer, Wigwam Stores out in Arizona, and they needed money, so I called up and told you guys." It was news to me. "Really?" I said. Then I got off the phone with Lou, and I went into David's office. "I understand that Lou Epstein gave us a referral to a company called Wigwam Stores," I said. "He went white," I said. "That's my fucking deal. Don't forget that." I looked David in the eye. "Is the deal done?" I asked. "It's done," he said. "Let me tell you right now," I said. "Anytime I bring a corporate client in, you come through me." I instantly knew what he was up to. He was going to pocket the fee and claim it for his own. But as wrong as he was ready to fight me on it. "We've got to go see Barrett Brown," he said. "Great," I said. "Let's go see him." We walk into the old man's office. He's smoking the pipe. "Mr. Brown," I said, "we talk about ethics in this firm. We talk about integrity, and we talk about values. The way I see it, all those things are like charity. They begin at home." I said, "I brought this relationship in. I maintain the relationship. This is my due. Mr. Brown, if I have to worry that I'm going to get picked off inside this firm, I don't need that. I can go outside, and all I'll have to worry about will be one thing, getting the customer and making him happy. And as we've seen," I looked at David, "I'm pretty good at that." "Oh, absolutely," the old man said. "David, how did this happen?" "Well," David began, "I was talking to Lou one day, and Lou," I broke in. David, "that's not the way it happened. Lou tried to reach me first, and then when he found out I wasn't in the office, he called you. I said, now, David, this deal is my deal, and Unit 15 gets 30% of the commission. If that's not the deal, Mr. Brown, then I'm working under false pretenses." "All right, fella," Brown said. "We're with you. David, are you agreed?" Another grudging nod from David. I knew, and the look on his face confirmed it, that I'd made a serious enemy out of this guy. I was doing part-time what he was doing full-time, and my labors would soon bear fruit, big time. Jack Cullen might not have known much about chasing butterflies, but he once taught me a lesson I would never forget. When one of our analysts came up with a buy recommendation for a company called Harbison Walker Refractories, they made refracting brick with super high heat tolerance, the kind they line steel furnaces with, I told Jack about it, and he made an appointment for me to go try to sell the stock to a man by the name of I.C. Mahana at Elfin Trust. GE managed its own pension fund for its employees. Elfin was the mutual fund the company ran for its offices. Shorty Mahana, they called him Shorty because he was only about this high, was a legendary fund manager, the guy who had bought Xerox at 19 cents a share in 1957, just a couple of years before it went through the roof. Xerox was so successful that Shorty kept having to sell the stock off as it rose because Elfin's rule was that no single holding could exceed 5% of the fund's total assets. A meeting with Shorty Mahana was a high-level one, and I was nervous. And in the cab on the way uptown, Jack said to me, "Listen to me, you're going to walk in there, and the first thing you're going to do is tell Shorty all the negatives, all the reasons why he shouldn't buy Harbison Walker Refractories. What's wrong, what could go wrong, what needs to be fixed, what can't be fixed." "What the hell are you talking about?" I said. "I'm going up there to tell him to buy it." Jack looked me in the eye. "You just remember," he said, "give him all the negatives first." "Why am I doing this?" I asked. "You just do it, and I'll tell you after we leave." "Okay," I thought, "this is my boss. I'm not going to screw around." We got to GE and were shown into Mahana's office. I was immediately intimidated. The only thing on his desk was a telephone, and when he stood to greet us, he really was short. We sat down, and I said, "Mr. Mahana, I'm here to sell you on a stock." but let me tell you all the reasons why you shouldn't buy it. What do you mean? He said. Well, I said, nothing is perfect, and I proceeded to go through a list of every downside to Harbison Walker. The company had a very limited product line, I told him, and faced strong competition in a limited market. A recession could impact it badly, and there were a couple of problems with its current management. Mahana looked thoughtful. Now I said, let me tell you why I like it. I said that because the economy was picking up, demand for steel looked like it was going to take off. I told him that Harbison Walker was the Cadillac of the industry. Everybody respected the quality of what they did, and they were also the lowest cost producer of their product. And the company was based in Pittsburgh. It had deep and strong relationships in the steel industry. Well, he finally said, do you like it more than you don't like it? Yeah, a whole lot more, I said. I think this is a great stock. Okay, he said. Let me think about it. And Jack and I left. In the cab downtown, I said, Jack, why did I just do that? I'm going to tell you why you did it. This afternoon, he's going to call up all of his buddies on Wall Street, and he's going to ask them, what do you think of Harbison Walker Refractories? He's going to have a checklist on that nice, clean desk of his. And if his pals tell him anything negative about the company, he's going to tick off the list. He'll say, well, Ken told me that. Ken told me that. Ken told me that. Your trust is going to go through the roof with him. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Shorty Mahana bought Harbison Walker through me, and then he bought a lot more. Lesson learned. My father-in-law at Shearson Hamel did nice business with Standard Oil in New Jersey and knew the guys there very well. He said, this is a good account. They're honorable people. You should try to get something going there. The head of my unit, Bindy Banker, was covering Standard Oil but doing nothing with them. I think I can do business with them, I told him. Fine, Bindy said. I'll arrange a lunch. Oh, boy, did he arrange a lunch. Three guys from Standard, New Jersey, Webb Williams, Bud Cohn, and their boss, Ted Lilly, accepted our invitation to lunch, and Bindy made the reservation at the Pinnacle Club in the Mobile Building on 42nd Street. And I'm saying to myself, but not to Bindy, is that smart to take guys from that company to a meal in their chief competitor's headquarters? We went to the Pinnacle Club. We were seated in a private room. Bindy ordered for everyone, and he was like the lord of the manor. Want a steak? How about a shrimp cocktail to start? Drinks all around. We ate our fancy meal, and the conversation was pleasant. But then suddenly, Bindy turned to our guest and says, look, I bought you guys lunch. Now you tell him why you don't do business with us. Bindy's pointing at me, and I'm squirming. This kid wants your account. Bindy says, I don't know what the hell we need to do to get business out of you guys. Radio silence. Pin drop silence. I'm bright red with embarrassment. I figure it's all over with Standard Oil, New Jersey. But these guys were polite and gracious in spite of it. They said everything except, Bindy, you don't do anything for us. You don't help us do our work. They didn't say that, but it was clear. In the cab back to the office, I said, Bindy, do me a favor. Let me have this account. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do business with these guys after the way you've put them through the ringer. But I want you to give me 1 year to try. If I can't do anything with it, you can have it back. You get a piece of whatever I do, I argued. You've got 100% of nothing now. At least you'll have some percentage of something if I'm successful. He saw my logic. Okay, kid, give it your best shot, Bindy said. The next week, I went to see Standard's point man, Webb Williams, at his headquarters in Rockefeller Center. Webb was a real gentleman, and I still felt embarrassed about that lunch. Webb, I want to tell you, first of all, that that's not my way of doing business, I said. I think I can help you guys, but I need to know what your definition of help is. He said, let me tell you how we work, and he laid it out. Standard Oil, New Jersey, had a very large pension fund, so large that it was spread among several different asset managers. The shorthand for them was banks, even though only some of them were also commercial banks, like Scudder Stevens, Continental Illinois, Chase Bank, and J.P. Morgan. Those money managers would buy and sell stocks for Jersey's pension fund through investment firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Using the pension fund's money rather than their own to pay the investment firm's commissions. In those days, a bank like Continental Illinois could say to an investment firm like R.W. Pressbridge, "Okay, Pressbridge, you want some of that business? You want some of those commissions? You have to deposit a substantial sum, say $100,000 with us." It was very clever. The banks would make loans with the investment firm's $100,000 and keep the interest for itself. The only money the bank would pay the investment firm in the form of commissions came out of the pension fund's pocket. This used to be legal. It no longer is. Standard Oil New Jersey didn't like that system. They said to the banks, "Wait a minute, guys. Those are our assets you're using to pay commissions with. We're going to decide who gets the commissions, not you." Webb Williams and his people met semi-annually with the asset managers, he told me. If they could go into those meetings thoroughly versed on current business trends and investment sectors, they'd be way ahead of the game. So I began to cultivate Webb. I took him to lectures at NYU Business School by famous economists like Theodore Eintema and Marcus Nather, and we'd have dinner afterward. I started to go up to Standard Oil, New Jersey once a month, and every time I went, I took an analyst with me, a guy who was covering a specific sector of the stock market. We would talk with Webb and the other guys in his department about the economy and certain areas we thought were good buys at the moment. Whenever they called with a question, I had an analyst make up a detailed report. Webb and his colleagues were always receptive, always interested. They weren't sending any commissions our way, but I felt it was just a matter of time. A few months went by. It was early 1964. One day, Bindi leans across the trading desk and says, "You see, all that damn time you've been spending with those guys, all that money you're spending with those guys, they're takers. They'll never do a thing with you." I said, "Bindi, what do you want me to do?" "You ought to nail them," he said. "You ought to say to them, 'Where's my business?'" "No, Bindi, that's not how I operate. I would never do that, and I'm not going to start now." "So what are you going to do?" he asked. "I'm going to keep servicing them. If I've overestimated our usefulness, they're going to tell me one day, 'Look, we've tried you. You don't add value.'" One day, in May 1964, I got a call from Webb Williams. He said, "I'd like you to come up and talk with Bud Cohen and me. Bud manages our relationships with all our banks." I took a cab up to Rockefeller Center and met with Webb and Cohen. "First of all, Ken, I want to apologize," Bud said in his nice Texas accent. They were all from Texas up there. It was the oil business. He told me which investment firms their banks had been dealing with, and then said, "I didn't realize we hadn't done any business with you guys yet. We were going to fix that today." I thanked him, and he said, "No thanks necessary, Ken. We just want you to keep doing exactly what you're doing for us, nothing more and nothing less." I got back to the office an hour later. The equity trading desk was one side of this big block-long desk. Harry Seaver was the head trader. Harry used to call me Languidoose. Why? I have no idea. He probably just liked the sound of it. "Languidoose," he called across the desk, "I just got a call from Continental Illinois. 3 orders for Standard Oil New Jersey. Big orders. They were buying 100,000 shares of one stock, 50,000 shares of another stock, and 90,000 shares of a third stock." I was just standing there with my mouth hanging open. This was over $75,000 of commissions in one day. Harry said, "The guy in Chicago told me, 'Don't worry, we've got some more to make up with you guys. We're calculating what it is right now, but we'll get back to you, because now you're on our list and we haven't come anywhere near paying you.'" I picked up the phone and I called Bud and Webb. "Guys," I said, "you could have knocked me over with a feather. I've never seen that much business in my life." Bud said, "Let me tell you right now, Ken, we deal with a lot of people on Wall Street. Your firm is more professional with us than anybody else we do business with. I went to see the old man. I used to call the partner's room Sleepy Hollow. Every day they would go out to lunch and drink at lunchtime, then come back and go to sleep in their chairs. Mr. Brown, I said, I just got a wonderful surprise from Standard Oil, New Jersey. What's that, fella? I got over $75,000 in commissions. Today? This morning. Harry just executed it now. He puffed on the pipe, looking impressed. Mr. Brown, I said, I want to do something, and I'd like you to agree to it. I want to allocate a certain percentage of those commissions to the research department for the analysts who helped bring in this business. Mr. Brown, these guys downstairs are great. I don't think you understand the quality of talent you've got down there. Brown wrinkled his nose. Well, they're all right. Mr. Brown, they're a lot better than that. Maybe it's how we use them that's not all right. But I can tell you right now, I can take these guys any place and do a lot of business. He shook his head. Well, if you want to give them bonuses from your end, go ahead. I shook my head back. I've got another idea, Mr. Brown. Let you and I pick a total dollar amount off the top of whatever I bring in from Standard Jersey or any other company going forward for analyst bonuses. Now, you're only going to have to pay 70% of it because I'm going to pay 30%. I'll tell you which analysts are higher on the approval list at Standard New Jersey, and you can decide how much you want to allocate to each analyst. It's completely fair, I said. He took the pipe out of his mouth. I don't know if I like that fella. All right, sir, then let me do it a different way, I said. I'm going to take a portion of Unit 15's 30% and give it to them directly. It'll cost you nothing. Why would you want to do that? Brown asked. Because, Mr. Brown, when I pick up the phone and call the research department, I want those guys to jump through the phone. I want these guys to keep doing as great a job as they've been doing, and I want them to be excited about it. Well, let me think about it, he grumbled. He called me back into his office the next day. Fella, I don't know what you're up to, and I'm not sure I like it, he says, but I'm going to go along with it. I'd given it some further thought. Fine, I said, and what I'd like to do is allocate points every quarter to each analyst on the basis of how much they've done. Then we'll take 20% of the commissions we generate from Jersey or any other account and give out bonuses based on total points. I want every analyst who's been instrumental to have a piece of that pie. That's complicated, the old man said. No, Mr. Brown, it's not complicated, it's fair. As I was leaving his office, I turned around. By the way, with the extra business I'm doing, I'm short-handed, I said. I'd like to hire a couple of kids. I want to train them to be salesmen. That got the pipe out of his mouth. No, 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 he said. We don't want any overhead. Let me see what I can figure out, I told him. I went and I talked to my three partners, who as a result of what I was now bringing in, were making so much damn money that if I told them to jump out the window, they would have jumped out the window. They'd never seen any business like that, and they knew they were going to get a piece. They also knew that it wasn't going to last forever. Each of them understood that at a certain point, and it wouldn't be long, I was going to come to them and say, hey, guys, this isn't fair. This is what I'm bringing in. Charlie Benedict, this is what you're bringing in. Bud Cannaday, this is what you're bringing in. Bindi, this is what you're bringing in. And I'm bringing in a hell of a lot more. But you guys are taking out as much as I am. What's wrong with this picture? They knew that was coming. I told them about my plan for hiring some young guys, and I told them I wanted to pay these kids well. I wanted to start them at $20,000 a year, which in 1965 was a lot of money. We would teach them, I said. We would take them on trips with us. And by the way, their salaries and expenses would all come off our Unit 15's gross. To his credit, Bindi agreed to it right away. He was and would continue to be very receptive to bringing new young guys into the firm. He understood just why it was so important. As a matter of fact, since less than 2 years earlier, I had been the new young guy at R.W. Pressbridge, I'd like to say now what a real debt of gratitude I owe to Bindi Banker. Bindi might not have known an asset from a liability, but he was smart and he was street smart. He not only taught me many crucial lessons in business and in life, he also instilled confidence in me at a key moment in the beginning of my investing career. Wall Street was a closed, waspy world back in those bad old days. Nepotistic. Bloodlines and family connections still meant a lot. And if I look deeply into myself, I see that even at the ripe old age of 27 and 28, I was still carrying some of the self-consciousness about my origins that I'd first taken to Bucknell. Here I was, a plumber's son from Long Island, a rough-and-ready Italian-American kid. What business did I have rubbing elbows with a high and mighty, let alone making big deals with them? Vindy Banker felt no such hesitation. He had all the social confidence that I lacked at that age. He came from the right WASP background. He'd been a Marine officer. He was the boss's stepson. He was a bon vivant and a man about town. He knew just how to dress and how to act. He knew all the right things to say to the right people, and he belonged to all the right clubs, the National Golf Links, Piping Rock Club, Racket and Tennis, the Downtown Association. By night, he haunted El Morocco and Le Club in 21, where he knew exactly what to order and whom to tip. The head waiters loved him. He was equally masterful at playing his connections and his relationships. He took me under his wing, he encouraged me, and he exposed me to a life I never knew existed. He got me involved in the Investment Association in New York and the Bond Club in New York. I guess Bindi saw from the jump that he and I could be each other's business other half. He was receptive enough to realize I had the investment savvy he lacked, and he was generous enough not to try to pick my brain and keep me in my place. He made damn certain that I was recognized, both in the firm and outside. Not everyone would have been so kind, believe me. The first big lesson Bindi taught me was one he taught by example. I'd begun encountering some of the big, big guys on Wall Street, legendary guys, men I'd read about in Fortune. These men were gods to me, and I saw right away that Bindi simply wasn't in awe of them. In short order, he taught me to understand that a man's public persona usually has very little to do with his private persona. Without that lesson, I would have felt subservient toward these muckety-mucks. But with that lesson under my belt, I felt completely equal to anyone I dealt with. And without Bindi in my life, I don't think I would be as certain of myself as I am and as outspoken as I am. Unlike Bindi, Charlie and Bud were resistant to my plan to bring new young guys into Unit 15, probably because they smelled what was coming. But finally they agreed, and I went back to Mr. Brown. "Okay, here's what we want to do," I told him. "When we hire these young guys, we want to pay them out of our commissions. That way all the business they do will have Unit 15's number on it." "Well, who's going to pay their fringe benefits?" Brown asked. "FICA, medical." I thought about it for a moment. "I guess we'll pay it all," I told him. He nodded. "Done deal." So we went ahead and started interviewing, and oh boy, did we find some terrific kids. The first two we hired were Tom Kane, T.F. Kane, a Marine fighter pilot just back from Vietnam, and his cousin, T.W., who was a preferred stock trader at Kidder Peabody. Like me, they'd grown up in households that were far from wealthy. Both their fathers worked on Wall Street, but as traders. Tom had gone to Fordham, and T.W. had graduated from St. John's. One led to another, and then another. We made an art form of finding these kids, and they would bring other kids to us. They were all cut from a certain cloth, young and smart and hungry as hell, and not one of them to the matter born. We hired a kid named Bruce Schroyer, and he brought in a Montana guy by the name of Bob Potts, who had been with him at West Point. T.F. Kane brought in Gene Kirkwood. We hired Frank Dunn, who brought in his brother Bill. Then we brought in Frank Martucci and Bob Kelly, all hungry, hard-working, decent kids. We placed them all around us at the Unit 15 desk and instructed them to always pick up the phone when we were on sales calls so they could listen and learn. One day, T.W. came to me and said he had a friend, a fellow St. John's graduate, who he thought would really be a great salesman on Wall Street. "Sure, bring him in," I said. I was headed out for a late lunch at the Bankers Club when T.W. introduced me to Ed Branagh. I took the two of them to lunch with me, and Eddie blew me away. Like me, he was a little rough around the edges. His old man was a lieutenant in the NYPD, he told me. But he was smart, he was aggressive, and I could tell he had a lot of common sense. Eddie's current job was selling electrical products for a big company called Graybar Electric, and he was doing well. "You're going to take a pay cut if you come to work for us," I told him. He smiled. Eddie Brown wound up becoming a phenomenal salesman. He would eventually leave Prestwich and go to Drexel Burnham, Oppenheimer, and then Prudential Beige, where he became the head of institutional sales. To me, Eddie was really the prime example of the democratization of Wall Street. These young guys traveled with us. Then they started going out on their own, the same way I had at first, covering accounts nobody had covered. They went to Canada, Des Moines, Iowa, Springfield, Illinois. They were bringing in business, and of course, I was out on the road too, bringing in more and more. And over the next 2 years, business just went through the roof, all from one bad lunch at the Pinnacle Club. Chapter 4, Making Waves. Early in my career at Prestbridge, I happened to remark to a colleague that I thought pipe smokers were slow thinkers. Word somehow got back to W. Barrett Brown. "Old fella," he said to me one day, "I understand that you think I'm a slow thinker." I thought as fast as I could. "No, sir," I said. "What I said was that most people I know that smoke pipes are slow thinkers. That doesn't mean you're a slow thinker." "Hmm," he said. I could tell he was pissed. Then I thought about it for a second and realized I didn't especially care. By 1965, I was spending less and less time selling securities and more on my first love, corporate finance, mergers and acquisitions. One day, Larry Victor, one of our research analysts, came to me and said, "There's a company I know that looks very interesting." Evans Products was a company in Portland, Oregon, that sold building materials and manufactured railroad car equipment, among other things. For boxcars that transported manufactured goods like refrigerators, they made a damage control system called Evans DF, an array of boards fastened across the width of the car that kept the contents from shifting and colliding if the train stopped short. Larry Victor introduced me to the CEO of the company, a guy named Manfred Orloff. Orloff had taken over the company from the Evans family when it was in rough shape, then steered it to profitability. He wanted to expand the company's railroad equipment business, so he bought a company, U.S. Railway Leasing in Blue Island, Illinois, that purchased old rail cars, reconditioned them, and leased them out to railroads. But now he wanted to buy more railroad cars, and he needed a substantial amount of money. One day when Larry and I were out in Portland, we got to talking with Orloff and his CFO, Luke Weigel. "I think we can get you financing for those railroad cars," I told him. "How much do you need?" "Around $15 million," Weigel said. I thought for a moment, "You're leasing out the cars, so whatever financing you get depends on the strength of your lessee's credit," I said. "The stronger their credit, the higher quality your debt. And since you have lessees like the major railroads, I think this financing is eminently doable." I went back to New York and started putting the paperwork together. An offering sheet, a list of the equipment Evans wanted to buy, the terms on the leases. One day, one of the senior partners at Prestbridge, Charlie Bergman, called me in and said, "Well, you really messed this one up. You've made Blythe & Company angry as all hell." Blythe & Company was another investment banking firm, but unlike Prestbridge, a very big and powerful one. When the people at Blythe did a major underwriting, say a $50 million bond deal for Georgia Pacific, they typically put together a syndicate of investment firms to handle it along with them. Prestbridge was small enough that we'd basically have to go begging to be included in deals like that. "You know that Evans Products is a client of Blythe & Company, don't you?" Charlie asked. "So what?" I said. "Well, you can't do what you're doing." "What are you talking about? What am I doing?" I said. "I went to Evans Products, I knocked on their door, I brought the business in. Do you realize how many other underwriters Blythe can go to besides us on any given deal? If we take business from them, they won't invite us in anymore. Charlie, I said, I'm going to make more money on this deal than you've made on all the underwritings you've ever done with Blythe, all the way back to when they gave you a piece of their first deal," I said. "I don't understand what you're upset about." "We've got to go over there and make peace," he said. "I don't need to make any peace, Charlie," I told him. "I won fair and square. If you feel you've got to go over and kiss their ass, you go right ahead. But I'm not going." And I said, "Better than that, Charlie. I'm doing this deal." And I did the deal and brought in another big commission. And I tucked away a thought in the back of my mind. Was a firm this stuck in its ways really the right place for me? I was beginning to get some real economic clout at Prestbridge. It wasn't just the deals. I was still selling stocks and bonds, and these kids we hired and trained, almost all of them were 26, 27, 28, and I was just 29, were doing fabulous. The firm's brokerage business was growing nicely because of us. By the spring of 1965, I was earning $100,000 a year on commissions alone, the equivalent of about $750,000 today. And I was being given broader responsibility all the time. We now had branches in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Albany, Hartford, Philadelphia, Chicago, Dallas, L.A., and San Francisco. And I was overseeing a lot of what they were doing, stopping in and spending time, ushering some old staff out of the firm and a lot of new staff in. Our third son, Stephen, was born in April 1965, and suddenly the house we'd bought just a couple of years before, 337 Ryder Road, Manhasset, was starting to feel a bit crowded. Part of it was psychological, I'll admit. Because I was doing so well, suddenly, it was easier to imagine living in a grander style. Elderfields Road in the Flower Hill section of Manhasset was the finest street on the north shore of Long Island. I'd always dreamed of living there, and now I realize the dream was within reach. Jack Clapp, a senior partner in charge of the municipal bond department at Prestbridge, lived on Elderfields Road. Of course, Jack was middle-aged, and I wasn't 30 yet. But I wasn't thinking about that. I had this bee in my bonnet, and one morning Jack told me that the man across the street from him had died, and his widow was living alone in the house, a big, beautiful Georgian, at the top of a wide, sloping lawn. Jack didn't know whether she was going to sell the place or not. So Elaine wrote a letter to the owner. Her name was Ruth Rebo. Her late husband had been CFO of S.H. Crescent Company, the five and dime chain. "We don't know if you're ever interested in selling your home," Elaine wrote, "but if you are, we'd like to buy it." And Mrs. Rebo phoned Elaine and invited her to come by. We both drove over. Mrs. Rebo, a nice-looking older lady, told us that she was probably going to leave the house. It was too big for her to live it alone, and that the estate was in the hands of Chase Bank. And she gave me the name of the officer at the bank who was handling the estate. So I went to a real estate broker in town and said, "What's that house worth?" "Oh, I'm going to guess it's around $75,000-$80,000, he told me. I called the trust manager at Chase Bank and said I would like to buy that house. I was prepared to bid $77,000 for it, and there wouldn't be any brokerage commissions involved. If the offer was accepted, I said, the late Mr. Rebo's estate would receive $77,000 net. I took a deep breath while I was waiting for his response. $77,000 was a lot of money for a house in 1965, and it was a lot of money for me. The man said he would look into the matter and get back to me. One day that summer, Elaine and I took Kenny and Bruce to the World's Fair out in Flushing. When I called into the office from a payphone to see if I had any messages, the secretary said to me, "Chase Bank called to tell you that you bought a house." I went back and told Elaine that 83 Elderfields Road was ours. She was thrilled. I was thrilled. But the truth is that buying that house for $77,000 was a big risk for me relative to my net worth at the time. Any number of things could have gone wrong. I could have wound up not being able to swing the payments. It's not the kind of bet I would make today. I can name too many people who were wealthy, very wealthy, even enormously wealthy, and wound up literally going broke. But I was young, and I had a lot of, well, pluck is the fancy term for it, and a lot of luck. That August, the old man called me into his office. "I'm not offering you anything, fella," he said, "but I just wanted to tell you that a partnership could be in the offing for you." "Thank you, Mr. Brown, but I'm not sure exactly what you mean," I said. "You're not offering me a partnership." "That's right. I just wanted to sound out your level of interest." "I think I'm interested," I said. "But what would it mean, exactly?" "Well," he said, "you wouldn't get commissions anymore. Instead, at the end of each year, you'd get a percentage of whatever the firm makes overall." "Hmm," I said. "How do I live in the meantime?" "You'll get a draw of $20,000 a year," he said. "But you wouldn't pay taxes on it because it's a draw. You don't pay your taxes until the partnership returns are filed." "Hmm," I repeated. "Well, are you interested?" "I think so," I said. "Okay, fella, I'll get back to you." A couple of months later, it's now October, Brad calls me in and says, come in and see me. I go in. Here's the deal, he says to me. We're offering you a partnership. You'll run your sales operation. We hope you'll keep doing deals if you can. But any deal you bring in has to go through the corporate finance department. I can't do that, I told him. Why? Because they don't know how to bring business in, I said. I don't need them to process my deals. You're wasting your money. That's not true, he said. We've got to be mindful of correct procedure here. Okay, I said, but I want to warn you. If I put together a deal, I'm going to get the deal done. I don't care what corporate finance does. He frowned and puffed on the pipe, but he didn't say no. Where do I come in, I asked. Meaning, where among the 23 partners at Prestbridge would I be ranked? You'll be ranked 24, he said. But every year we reevaluate who does what, and you'll move up if your performance merits it. I don't want that deal, I told him. He looked a little shocked. Why not? I don't want it, I repeated. I'll stay on commissions. I could see exactly what this was all about. It was killing them how much money I was making. None of the partners were earning that kind of money. They wanted to cut my pay, put me on a leash. This was an offer for them, not for me. Look, Mr. Brown, I said, you know what we call the section of the trading room where the senior partners sit? We call it Sleepy Hollow. Why do you call it that? Because those partners go out and get drunk at lunch, and then they come back in the afternoon and sleep until it's time to wake up and go across the street to the bar and get drunk again, I said. I'm not going to wait through that group. I want to come in at number 12 or not at all. He takes out the pipe. How'd you come up with that number? My numbers easily put me in the top half, I told him. I'm not coming in at the bottom. I haven't got that many years left. I don't know if I can do that, the old man said. That's fine, I said. I'll stand away and make deals. You're going to make a lot of money off me. I'm not going anyplace. I'm doing very well. I'm happy. Well, we really feel you've got a lot of potential. I appreciate that, I said. I was doing my best to be diplomatic. It had been a little more than 8 years since I'd started at the Equitable for $82.50 a week, bringing my lunch and eating it in the public waiting room in Grand Central Terminal, and now I was earning well into six figures. Potential. But in a certain way, Brown was right. I knew my biggest days were in front of me. He called me the next day. Well, we're going to do it, he told me, but there are going to be a lot of unhappy people. Mr. Brown, I don't want anybody unhappy, I said, but it would be crazy for me to have to slog through 11 people when I know I'm going to do more in my first month than they're doing the whole year. If you want to keep them as your partners, that's your business. Don't you want to know what your percentage would be at number 12? I shook my head. That doesn't matter to me, I said. I was telling him the truth. I'm more concerned about where I'm going to be in 5 years. I'm happy to start in the middle of the pack. W. Barrett Brown told me I would start at 3.5% of the firm's earnings per annum, and I told him that was just fine with me, so I did it. I became a partner at R.W. Prestbridge on January 1, 1966. I had turned 30 just 3.5 months before. Word got around. Soon after, I got a call from, of all people, my old boss at the Equitable, Bill McCurdy. McCurdy, you'll remember, was the prick who called me a square peg in a round hole. The guy whose nose got out of joint when his boss told him he was going to have to find a place for me. Now he wanted to have lunch with me. We went out for lunch, and he sits down across from me with a big grin on his face. I always knew you were a winner, he tells me. I always knew you were going to be somebody in this business. I gave him my best fake smile. Well, thank you, Bill, I said. He leaned across the table, looked around to make sure nobody was listening, and lowered his voice. I just wanted to say, if you see any especially good deals, anything I could be interested in, I hope you're going to give me a call. Sure, Bill, I said. I'll be happy to give you a call. 3 years later, in one of the earliest leveraged buyouts in American financial history, R.W. Prestbridge brought the F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, taking it public, in a $106 million stock offering. David G., who was friends with a lawyer who represented the Schaefer family, had brought in the deal. The Equitable participated in the financing, and McCurdy was the officer on the account. And he called me up and asked me to keep in mind opportunities that he could invest in personally. Bill, I said, I don't feel good about a personal investment relationship as long as you're responsible for the relationship between Prestbridge and the Equitable. I didn't hear from Bill McCurdy again after that. Not long after Shorty Mahan and GE followed my recommendations on Harbison Walker Refactory and was very pleased at the outcome, I took him to lunch at the Bull and Bear in the Waldorf Astoria. Shorty was a straight shooter and a good guy, and I wanted to cultivate him as an advisor and a friend. He became both, and by the way, I never called him anything but Mr. Mahan. While we were eating lunch that day, the subject of Rudy Smutney came up. Rudy was a senior partner at Prestbridge, an old Wall Street hand who was head of the firm's railroad equipment financing business. You know, Shorty said, I like Rudy, I just don't trust him. I tucked the remark away for future reference. Smutney had come to Prestbridge in the late 1950s after being forced out of Salomon Brothers, where he'd been a senior managing partner. He was a tough little guy with a long nose, cold eyes, and a bald dome. And he didn't just look tough. He'd been a Marine officer in World War II. In 1968, when the firm incorporated, the partners elected him president. Rudy Smutney had a reputation for being ruthless. He scared a lot of people. One day after he became president, he came up to me and said, you know, I can't tell you how much I admire you. You get things done. You really get things done. He began walking away from me and then turned around. But stop producing, Rudy said, and see how quick I stop liking you. Now, another guy might have said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? The guy's telling me he's going to fire me. But that wasn't me, and not because I was so tough or brave. I was just realistic. I knew exactly what I had to do. I had three kids to feed and educate and provide a home for, and all I knew, I had to go out and kill every day to eat. So I wasn't producing for Rudy Smutney. I was producing for my family. And I was producing big time. By 1968, I was a number five partner at Prestbridge, and the firm had a really hot hand. We were doing business all over. Now, 4 years early, Bindi and I had hired a former Davis Cup tennis player named Ham Richardson to run our Dallas office. Ham came from Baton Rouge, and he once worked as an aide to Senator Russell Long. Every year, the Louisiana delegation to Congress held a Mardi Gras ball in Washington, and in early 1968, Ham Richardson got Elaine and me invited to the party. We were seated at a very interesting table. Across from me was Gus Levy, the number one guy at Goldman Sachs, who was also from Louisiana. And next to me was a friend of Ham's from Dallas by the name of Jack Haidt. Jack and I got to talking, and he told me that the company he'd co-founded was ready to go public, and they were talking to underwriters now. The company, Electronic Data Systems, or EDS, was doing big business in Texas in a new field, computer facilities management. Among its clients were several big banks, Frito-Lay and Texas Blue Shield and Blue Cross. Gee, I said, is there any chance we can get in to make a pitch? Call me on Monday, I'll let you know, Jack said. And we went back to drinking and raising hell and having a great time. I called first thing on Monday morning. Jack, how did I do? I asked. You got an appointment at 11:30 Wednesday morning in Dallas with my partner, Ross Perot, Jack said. You got to be there on the dot of 11:30, and you've got to be out exactly at 12 o'clock. I'm going to tell you two things. Be on time and leave on time and don't swear. Perot hates profanity. I made a mental note to temper my customary conversational style. I flew down to Dallas with two people we just hired in the corporate finance department at Prestbridge, Duke Glenn and Roger Green. We walked into Perot's secretary's waiting area, and even though I don't scare easily, there was something intimidating about the place. There was a big clock on the wall, for one thing, and as soon as that second hand hit 12 on the dot of 11:30, bam, the door opens and we're shown in. Perot had his desk catty-corner, don't ask me why, and he was such a little guy that he barely came over the top of it. He might have even been shorter than Shorty Mahan. Perot at his desk reminded me of one of those old Kilroy Was Here cartoons from World War II with a guy's eyes just peeping over the top of a wall. Hi, he yelled out in a Texas accent, Ross Perot. Mr. Perot, Ken Langone, Roger Green, and Duke Glenn, happy to meet you. Well, let's sit down and talk a little bit, Perot said, and for the next 29.5 minutes, he did all the talking. It was impossible to work a word in edgewise through his steady monologue About all the big-time underwriters that had approached him, 13 in all, all of them much larger firms than Prestbridge, including Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Salomon Brothers, Allen & Company, and G.H. Walker. This is what Goldman Sachs told me, Perot said, and he told us just what Goldman Sachs had told him. This is what Kidder Peabody told me. This is what Merrill Lynch told me, on and on for 29 minutes. After what felt like forever, he turned to me. Okay, now what have you got to say? I glanced at my watch. Mr. Perot, Jack told me I had exactly 30 minutes, not a second more, I said. I see I just have enough time right now to say goodbye. Maybe you can see me some other time. What do you mean? What do you mean? Jack said I had just 30 minutes. Ah, forget that, Perot said. What do you think of what I said? I figured I'd already blown the 30-minute rule. I might as well break the other one, too. Mr. Perot, I said, that's the biggest pile of horseshit I ever heard in my life. He reared back in his chair. Whoa, he yelled. What do you mean? Well, Mr. Perot, these firms are telling you all kinds of things. What I'm telling you is I'm going to value your stock at the highest possible price consistent with having a successful offer. It's that simple. All the stuff in the middle is bureaucracy. You want to sell at that price? I got to find a buyer at that price. That's it. He looked at me. I've got to talk to you some more, he said. Sure, I said. We'd been planning to return to New York on a 3 o'clock plane. Instead, we stayed with him until 1 o'clock in the morning. We just talked and talked and talked for 13 hours. It turned out that Perot and his wife were married the same hour, the same day, the same year as Elaine and I. His father was a cotton broker and my father was a plumber. At 1 a.m., he was driving the three of us around Dallas looking for a motel with a vacancy and a drugstore where we could buy shaving gear and underwear. We finally found a motel. I have a lot to think about, Perot said when he dropped us off. I went back to New York on the first flight in the morning. That afternoon, Thursday afternoon, I got a call from him. I haven't made my mind up, he said. I want to get to know you better, and I want to learn some more about this whole process. How can I help you know me better, I asked. Well, when you get a chance, come on down here again. No, Mr. Perot. I'm not going to take a chance on this. When do you want to see me? Well, what about next week? I'll be there Monday morning, I said. Hey, Ken, he said. Yes, sir. Do me a favor. When you come down, bring down the prospectuses of all the offerings you've done. Yes, sir, I said. But the fact was I didn't have any because we hadn't done any. I put together deals all over the place, corporate financing deals, corporate purchase deals, but I'd never done an IPO. I was hoping he'd forget about the prospectuses. I went down to Dallas, and we talked some more. It went well. Perot introduced me to his people, including his number two guy, Mitch Hart. I liked Mitch a lot, and over the years we would become very close friends. He'd graduated from Annapolis the year after Perot, then he'd gone into the Marines. He prided himself on his nose for people, he told me, and he smiled at me when he said it. Then Perot drove me to the airport. By the way, Ken, he says, do you have those prospectuses? I said, no, sir, I don't. Forget them? No, sir, I didn't forget them. What do you mean? There aren't any, I said. You're it. What do you mean I'm it? You'll be the first one I'll do. He gave me a long look. Ross, I said, by now we were on a first-name basis. Your deal is going to get done because you've got a great company and investors are going to want it. An idiot could do your deal. I've got a bigger risk in this than you do. If I mess up your deal, my one chance of success is gone. But if I do a great job for you, Prestbridge's reputation is enhanced. We have every incentive, and I promise you I will handle every detail of this deal myself. I later found out, after I returned to New York, Mitch Hart told Perot, that's the guy. This was March, and Perot and I kept talking for 3 months. One day he wanted to know what I thought his company was worth. I said, look, I'm going to be honest. Your company is one of a kind. I've never seen one like it before, ever. I'd be very comfortable putting a valuation of $160 million on EDS. $160 million, he said. I'm going to make about $1.5 million this year. $160 million is more than 100 times earnings. Right, I said. You really can do it for 100 times earnings, he asked. That meant if the current earnings were 15 cents a share, EDS would sell for $15 a share. It was a stratospheric number. All the other firms were coming in at 30 and 40 times earnings. I think so, I said. I meant what I said. It was a unique company. I'd never seen anything like it, and I thought it was going to grow like a weed. I was willing to bet on the future. At 100 times earnings, it would be way overvalued. But it would only be overvalued until it grew, and then it wouldn't be. Okay, Perot said, let me think about it. One day in the midst of our discussions, it was late May or early June 1968, strange thing happened. Perot called me up and said, how do you feel about having a partner? What do you mean, I asked. He started telling me about a guy he'd gone to Annapolis with, who is now a partner at G.H. Walker, a firm that incidentally had been founded by George Herbert Walker Bush's grandfather. My friend Jerry Lodge at G.H. Walker called up and said, if you do it at 100, he'd do it at 100, Perot said. Ross, I said, let me ask you a question. How comfortable would you be if I'm driving a car and we're going 150 miles an hour and I have the steering wheel and you have the brakes? What do you mean? All I've got is the steering wheel and all you've got is the brakes and I'm going 150 miles an hour. I get your point, he said. Ross, look, I said, if you feel so strongly about wanting G.H. Walker in on this deal, I'm not going to cut my wrists. Why don't you do the business with them, and you and I will do business another time. Now we know each other, and I think we have a good relationship. No problem. I'm not doing that, he said. I'm not doing that. They wouldn't have come to me with that number unless you had first. Well, that's probably right, I said. And for the umpteenth time, he said, I'll call you back. A couple of hours later, he calls me back. You know, Ken, Perot says, Mitch and I were just saying the only thing that scares the hell out of us about doing business with you is you don't show much enthusiasm. What? Yeah, Perot said, I don't feel the passion. Ross, I said, what are you doing tonight? I'm coming to Dallas. He gave a dry chuckle. Ken, we Texans think anybody that's from Texas has a good sense of humor, and nobody from outside Texas knows a good joke when he hears one. Well, I didn't think that was particularly funny, I said, but if you want me to come down there, I'll be there in a few hours. Lying going, you can stay right where you are. Let's do business. And we did. The world thought I'd gone nuts, but we did the deal. That was June. It took 3 months to get all the paperwork done, and then it was time to complete the actual transaction, which needed to occur in New Jersey, because the process of Prestbridge, the managing underwriter, buying EDS shares and then selling the shares would have incurred a transfer tax in New York. The way the firms customarily got around the problem was to go to New Jersey, which didn't have a transfer tax, and sign all the papers there. The night before the underwriting, Ross and his wife Margot and Elaine and I, by now we'd gotten to be good friends, were having dinner at 21. It was Wednesday, September 11th, 1968. After dinner, Elaine had to go back home because kids had school the next morning, so Ross and Margot and I were going to drive through the Holland Tunnel to the first pull-off in Jersey City to sign the papers, then turn around and come right back in. It was customary to have the limousine driver be the witness. We're driving through the Holland Tunnel. Ross and Margot are in the back seat, and I'm in the jump seat facing them. Perot looks me in the eye. Well, he says, they tell me this is when you're going to admit you can't do the deal you said you'd do. What do you mean, Ross? Well, all those guys you knocked off at White Weld and Goldman and Merrill Lynch and Kidder Peabody, they're all telling me there's no way you can do it at 100 times earnings, and you won't do it at 100 times earnings. Ross, they're right, I said. This caught him by surprise. What do you mean? They're right, I said. We're not doing it at 100 times earnings. He points his finger at me. I knew it, he said. He turned to his wife. See, Margot, they're all alike up here. They're all the same. They get us up here, and then they pick the skin off our body. Now, Margot was sitting directly across from me, and as we went through the tunnel and the lights flashed on our faces, I gave her a wink. Ross didn't see it, but she caught it. I could see just a hint of a smile on her face. Meanwhile, Perot is still raising hell. You're all the same, he's yelling. You guys have no idea what giving your word means, on and on. I held up my hand. Ross, wait a minute, I said. Hold it. If 100 times earnings means that much to you, I'll do it at 100 times earnings. That calmed him down just a little. Damn right it means something, he said, because you Wall Street guys have got to learn something. Your word is your bond. When you say you're going to do a thing, then by God, you've got to do what you say. Ross, please, I'm very, very happy to do it at 100 times earnings. Then Margot, God bless her, a great lady, turned to me with a twinkle. What were you going to do it at, she asked.